This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I've got a great show lined up for you. I've got two special guest experts joining me today. Joining me momentarily will be Mr. John Duty. John is with Gold Stock Analyst. He is a newsletter publisher with 21 years of track record. We're going to talk to him about buying gold or gold stocks. What should you do? He's got some great ideas and insights. He'll be joining me in just a moment. He'll also be joining me again on next week's program. Also on today's program, a very colorful guest, Mr. Jim Willey. Jim will be joining me in the second segment of today's program. And I'd like to remind you, if you have not yet had an opportunity to attend our new retirement rules class, there's just one more class coming up this year. It will be held on Saturday, November 14th at the Grand Rapids campus of Western Michigan University. You can get more information by visiting the website, newretirementrules.com. The website, again, newretirementrules.com. You can get more information about the class there or register while there is capacity. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. John Duty. John is the editor and publisher of the Gold Stock Analyst. And John, welcome to the program.
Well, great, Dennis. Great to be with you for the first time. Hopefully, there'll be more following.
Well, based on the conversation we just had, I'm sure there will be. Let me start, John, by just asking you just to explain to the listeners, what is the Gold Stock Analyst? Describe a little bit about what it is that you do every day.
I like to start off with, how I got into this business, because I was an academic for 20 years, a professor of economics and finance at Bentley University outside of Boston. And I started playing around with gold stocks in the late 80s because I was skeptical of the government and monetary policies, and I was trying to figure out a method to figure out which gold stock should you buy, because, as you know, they're all different sizes. The stock prices are all over the place, the number of shares. Some produce very little gold. Others produce a lot of gold. And I basically I developed and refined three metrics that I use to try to figure out which stocks are the best and most interesting to buy, and I applied those to my own portfolio investing back then. And then I realized that it was really a void in the marketplace, that nobody was providing this information for investors. And so I started the newsletter in 1994. And so here we are in our 21st year, and it's been a great ride.
Well, John, I think one of the things that we've talked about here on the program is how economies move in cycles and how the behavior of politicians sometimes is predictable. And we've talked a lot about current monetary policy, and you alluded to this in your comments just a moment ago, that given the quantitative easing and money printing that's going on all around the world, we've advised listeners that you ought to at least consider owning some gold in your portfolio. So my question for you is, Should a listener consider owning gold, or should a listener consider owning gold stocks, and why?
Well, the answer to both is yes. I personally own some gold. I don't own it in an ETF. I own it physically hidden away. But I believe that the best way to be invested in the gold arena is to own stocks, because over time they greatly outperform the metal itself. And when the gold price is going up, you can look at a company from two standpoints. What has it got for current production, and what does it have for reserves, the ounces that they've still got to mine in the future? And when the gold price goes up a dollar, every ounce that they're currently producing is worth a dollar more. So that dollar goes right to the bottom line, their profits increase. But also the ounces that they've still got in the ground, and a gold miner typically has about 10 times its annual production in ounces still in the ground. So every one of those ounces that's still in the ground is worth a dollar more. And so if you've got 10 times the annual production, that's 10 times the dollar more in value. And, of course, the number of shares didn't change or anything else. And that increase in value of the assets is primarily why the gold stocks outperform gold by a factor of two on average over all ups and down markets. Now, of course, it could work the other way, too. If the gold price goes down, the same analogy holds, that the stocks go down more than the gold.
So, John, describe, if you will, what's happened in the gold sector, and admittedly, I'm more familiar with the metal itself than I am mining stocks, so you're educating me along the way here as well. But just describe, you know, since gold peaked at, I think it was $1,923 an ounce, and today it's, you know, between $1,150 and $1,200 as we're talking, what's happened to gold stocks during that time frame?
Well, a couple of things. First, how do we get to that peak is worthwhile considering. And I think somebody coined the term tourist investors. When gold came off of its 253 low at the turn of the millennium and made this upward surge and then finally got going in the mid-2000s, 2005 and 6 and so forth, that price appreciation attracted investors who wouldn't normally be in the gold market. And they got it in as a momentum play. And it just as happens to any particular stock, it happened to gold too. And so the gold price really got driven probably higher than it should have been at that time. Of course, we didn't recognize it, and I don't think anybody did at the time, because we're all thinking we're bullish for gold. That's the only reason to be invested in gold, is because you're bullish on gold. And it probably overshot. So what we've seen since then is a pulling back of the gold price, a realization that the world wasn't going to collapse or didn't collapse, which was partly what people were thinking in 2009, 10, and 11, right up to that peak. And as the world didn't fall apart, money came out of the metal, and particularly the ETFs, the gold ETFs, were a big reason why gold went up so high, because when you buy the ETF, when you buy shares in the ETF has to turn around and take that money and buy gold. So that investors piling into the ETF, which was an easy way to own gold that had never existed before 2004, I believe, that drove the gold price higher. And as they got out, the ETF then had to turn around and sell that gold. And the selling of the ETF was greatly responsible for the fall in the price of gold. The biggest ETF has only about half of the gold it had at the peak in it. So that the arrival of the tourist and the departure of the tourist had a big role to play in the gold price. And we've gotten now to around the $1,100, $1,200 range, and this is probably where gold has to be to have an ongoing viable industry. That if the gold price fell to 1,000 or below, a lot of mines would close. The companies have already done a lot of cutting back on their own anyway. But below $1,000, I don't see as a possibility, because you'd get mine closures, and you get a whole change in the psychology if the big miners start closing down mines. That investors would realize that this is $1,000 is too low for the industry to be viable, and I think they'd bid the price of gold back up. So. You know, we're sort of at an equilibrium here. Companies are figuring that yes, we can survive at $1,100, $1,200 gold, and they're sort of marking time for their, you know, to expecting the price to go up, maybe not exponentially over the future, but in a rising basis on a number of factors that we see. We probably agree on a number of these, but we see coming in the market. And the first, of course, is of fear of fiat currency and, you know, the government overrunning its printing press, and you know what happens to the value of the dollars that we hold when that ultimately comes to play.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Mr. John Doody. You can get more information on John's work at goldstockanalyst.com. I'd encourage you to do that. And Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. Just a reminder, I will be chatting on next week's program again with Mr. John Doody. Joining me just momentarily will be the very colorful Jim Willey. I had an opportunity to catch up with Jim this past week. I want to remind you, a couple resources are available. Our free newsletter is available by visiting yourretirementoutlook.com and signing up. And you can get more information about our new retirement rules class to be held on November 14th at newretirementrules.com. I am pleased to have joining me as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Jim Willey. Jim is the editor of the Hat Trick Letter, found on goldenjackass.com. And Jim, welcome to the program. Pleasure to have you.
Oh, it's good to be on, Dennis.
Jim, you have talked a bit in your letter and on your website about the idea of a gold trade settlement platform. Can you explain to the listeners exactly what that is?
It's basically using gold trade notes as letters of credit. And, you know, bear in mind that for the last 20, 30 years, trade has been settled almost exclusively in the dollar, and in the last few years, a declining percentage, as more and more is being used for, say, in the Chinese yuan, also known as the RMB. But there are other other currencies that are often used too, like the British pound. But since QE began in 2012, which I fully forecasted in advance, the hyperinflation, we as Americans and the central bank, you know, the Department of Treasury, U.S. government, the central bank operating as an arm that basically has control of the U.S. government, the banker control, cabal has control of the U.S. government. Since QE and the African style third world monetary policy of printing trillions, we forced the world to look for an alternative. And the alternative, I think, Dennis, is going to be the gold trade note. They're going to move away from the dollar, and you're seeing a lot of movement in that same direction now, away from the dollar in the Persian Gulf with oil. The entire petrodollar foundation system and structure has been dismantled. And that is why the dollar is rising. It is not from, as the clowns running Washington state, it is not from a strong U.S. economy. It's from complex derivatives that form the petrodollar derivative foundation. They're being liquidated. And as these trillion-dollar contracts are liquidated, there is dollar demand, and it's all paper. So paper dollar demand is driving the dollar up, and it's basically wrecking the entire oil sector because that cantilever, it's like a seesaw. What one side goes up, other side goes down. The dollar's going up, the oil price is going down. The oil price is not going down because of huge glut. That's only a small part of the equation. The bigger one is that the petrodollar derivative machinery is being dismantled. So the whole world is looking for alternatives to the dollar, and that's why you see a lot of following of the RMB movements, like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and like the BRICS New Development Bank. That's not really a development bank. It's a gold conversion bank office. They're going to convert treasury bonds to gold bullion to form the basis of a new global currency system.
So Jim, let me jump in there because you talk about the fact that, you know, trade was done almost exclusively in the dollar, let's just say 15 to 20 years ago. How much market share has the U.S. dollar lost as far as international trade is concerned?
I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but I think it's something on the order in the last 15 to 20 years. It's gone from 80% to 60%. But it's moving fast, Dennis. It's more than that. There's another side. Okay, one side is trade. The other side is banking. The parallel question is, what percentage of non-dollar bonds are being used in global banking reserves? And that amount is rising, and it's even more alarming on that side. Just in the last 3 months, for instance, the RMB-based bonds have moved from about 2% to 8%.
And that's in 3 months.
3% to 8%. That's the accelerant right now causing the big, big problem. So you have to look at the dollar percentage of banking reserves and the dollar share of trade settlement. They're both falling and falling fast. You could look at it and say, well, gee, it's only down 7%, 8% in the last year or so. No, that's a lot. That's a lot because it used to be the standard.
Jim, my question is, it occurs to me that as countries around the world move away from the dollar and they start getting rid of dollars, those dollars are going to end up back in the United States. Does that mean that we're going to see a hyperinflation, or will, you know, high debt levels continue to have the U.S. economy kind of just muddling through?
This is a very delicate question. I'm glad you brought it up. Because there is no bond market. There is no supply and demand dictating the interest rate. There is no bond market, period. Notice that in the last 3 months, you've had $250 billion worth of Chinese-held treasury bonds dumped on the market, yet the interest rate on the 10-year, the bond yield on the 10-year bond for the U.S. Treasuries, has gone under 2%. They're just printing money to cover it, Dennis. There is no bond market. We're printing trillions. I've got an article that I wrote in late August. It made a lot of splash. It pointed out how there were $40 billion per day in failures to deliver sold treasury bonds. Wall Street is selling treasury bonds naked. They're selling what they don't own. And the Fed is passing it through the reverse repo window, which is getting a lot of publicity, and it was not known at the time in August when I made this statement, but I said that if there's all this trillion per month in failures to deliver treasury bonds, then we've got something very big going on. It's hidden $1 trillion per month of QE from the Fed. They're printing $1 trillion a month. And that's used to help the big Wall Street banks to cover their oil hedges, which are a disaster. And it also laps up all the sold bonds from foreign entities like China. And not just China, several nations. So when you say that, are we going to get hyperinflation? We've had hyperinflation since 2012, but they've created a firewall that it's only for the benefit of the financial firms, and that money. To get hyperinflation in prices, like, you know, the price of gasoline, the price of shoes, the price of a gallon of milk, the price of a plumber coming by for an hour, that's being held back because the money is not getting outside the financial sector, namely Wall Street. They've got these firewalls. They're preventing, with the financial regulatory bill, the Dodd-Frank regulatory bill, FinReg also called, financial regulatory bill, they're preventing credit extension. They want this implosion to be for the benefit of the bankers. And now there's another side to this politically. As you have the implosion, they're going to try to install the fascist state, which started in 2001 on that day of infamy in September.
Jim, we have about 2 minutes left in this segment. The late economist Herbert Stein said, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. Obviously, this has to stop. What does the end game look like here, in your opinion?
The fracture of the U.S. Treasury bond market. And you're already seeing it. You're seeing the Fed's reverse repo window go up a couple trillion dollars in a few months. That's a break. That's a break and a fracture. You're seeing negative interest rates in 20 nations. That's a fracture. You're seeing negative rates occasionally on dollar swaps. That's where, say, a French bank wants a bunch of dollars to handle an emergency liquidation of something or other. All right, a negative dollar swap is a fracture. The negative repo is a fracture. We're seeing fractures everywhere. The problem, Dennis, is that Joe Sixpack and the average, even educated American, has no idea what a repo market is, or window, no idea what a reverse repo is, no idea what a dollar swap is, no idea the impact of negative rates, and has no idea that there's an exchange stabilization fund managing the treasury bonds with a large, large component in making fabricated demand for treasuries in the interest rate swap derivatives. They're using 0% money, converting the zero cost money to make artificial demand for the treasury bond. They're using machinery to keep things going, and the average American has no idea. All they see is, well, gosh, I can get a mortgage for under 4% now. Isn't that great? But, you know, I don't have good steady income, so I'm not going to take advantage of it. We were told a half a year ago that the lower oil price was going to really be a benefit to the U.S. economy. No, it hasn't. We got a constant 4% and 5% recession going on in the U.S. economy. Constant. Because they're lying by 6%. on inflation.
Well, we are going to have to leave it there for this segment. When Everything Financial Radio returns, we'll continue our conversation with Mr. Jim Willey, editor of the Hat Trick Letter. Stay with us.
Give me your money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Joining me on today's program is Mr. Jim Willey. Jim is the editor of the Hat Trick Letter, found on goldenjackass.com. And, Jim, let's just jump right in the time we have here. You know, quantitative easing is the term used for money printing, and you mentioned in the last segment that there's been a lot of stealth money printing going on. Is it your view then that this obviously is going to have to continue moving ahead because the Fed has no other choice?
Exactly. In fact, they had a test. They called it taper talk in the summer of 2013. It was all nonsense, propaganda, trial balloons. They cannot taper the QE. They cannot reduce the hyperinflation. They cannot cut back on the free money dispensation for Wall Street covering their toxic bonds. They cannot stop it, because if they do, we see an instant rise in the Treasury bond yield up to 10% like Greece, because we look worse than Greece. We have $1 trillion annual deficit for the government. We have $500 billion deficit on trade. That's every year. That's ridiculous. It's $1.5 trillion a year that has to be covered. Okay, so they talk about cutting back, and they do so only because they want to maintain credibility. They can't stop printing money because we cannot finance the federal debt. It is that simple. We must continue the nonsensical talk, deceiving the public, lying to the financial press, lying in every FOMC meeting with the Federal Reserve. They cannot stop anything. All they talk about is the economy is getting better, and it's not. They talk about inflation being 2% when it's 8 or 9. So their lie is 6%. So when they say that we have a 2% growth, it's really minus 4. And that's every year since Lehman in 2008. We cannot stop the money printing because it would wreck the bond market. It would wreck the entire economy, because who would buy a car if they had to pay 15%? We're lucky to sell cars now when they're offering half that interest rate. We can't sell houses now with under a 4% interest rate. Now, QE, in summary, this is a perspective that I find pathetic among professional economists. I'm not a professional economist. I actually put in my bio that I have a PhD in statistics from Carnegie Mellon, 1980, and I am unencumbered by the limitations of economics credentials, which means I'm not badly educated. It means I'm not stupid like economists who talk about, you know, inflation expectations. What the hell is that? Who cares what inflation expectations? I care about what QE is, and what QE does is it forces, through the free money printing, it forces two things. It forces foreign nations like Korea to look for an alternative, because they don't want to hold treasuries if we're printing them. The second thing is it forces all the nations of the world and all the big financial entities of the world to hedge against the dollar by investing in something like, we call it hard assets, gold, you know, a copper mine, commercial buildings, farmland, something tangible. And the result of that reaction is the entire cost structure has risen. And the Fed and its governors have admitted in the last couple months, I give them some credit for being a little bit honest when they're mostly liars and corrupt thieves. They're admitting that they did bring about some inflation, but in the wrong places. Yes, exactly. In the cost structure. The cost structure has gone up, and the profit margins have gone down, and businesses are shutting down.
So, Jim, if at a certain point then the U.S. dollar loses reserve currency status, in the last segment we talked about the fact that the Fed has lost, or excuse me, the dollar has literally lost 25% market share. When do you see the dollar officially becoming a domestic-only dollar, that it loses reserve status?
It's a process that I believe has already begun. I can't say, well, by next April, we're going to be finished with this process. It's about a 20-step process. And here are some of the main steps. The trade settlement is gradually going to be more and more non-dollar. That's really important. It means that nations are going to buy vessels full of containers or vessels full of oil or vessels full of cement and copper, and they're going to pay for it not in dollars. They're not going to pay for it in treasury bills. This is the key point. Nations of the world are not going to pay for the shipped imports with dollars, namely treasury bills, those short-term instruments. If they don't pay for these cargo in dollars, they're not going to store the dollars in their banking systems. So the reserves for, I love the example of South Korea. It's a pretty important nation. It's not the biggest nation in Asia, but it's got, you know, LG, Hyundai, and oh gosh, now what's the third one? There's another big one. It's Samsung.
Kia.
Yeah. Kia, Samsung. Kia is probably their fourth biggest. Anyway, so nations like South Korea are going to conclude, well, we're not using treasury bills to pay for the cargo coming in. And for Asia, it tends to be more raw materials coming in. For the United States, it tends to be more finished products coming in. So if South Korea doesn't pay for cargo with treasury bills, they're going to conclude that they don't need to store them in treasury bills in their banking system. That's a key breakpoint. Okay, I think we're going to see a gigantic splash in the next couple of months. It could be the next few weeks. I believe the Arabs and UAE, along with other Gulf Emirate nations, are going to make a huge announcement that they will accept RMB payments for oil. And that will be the formal declaration of the death of the petrodollar. We've had a meeting in the last week between the prince, the crown prince of Saudi, and a couple of sheikhs, important sheikhs in UAE. UAE, United Arab Emirates, is a very interesting structural kingdom. It's a group of like city-states, a group of sheikdoms. So a couple of representatives, sheikhs, joined the crown prince Saudi. They went to the Kremlin, and they were joined quietly by some Chinese representatives, and they, so I am told, not only talked about Syria, not only talked about security matters regarding Saudi Arabia, they talked about ironing out the details of RMB sales for oil sold to Asia and in particular to China. Okay, once you get that, you've got a gigantic trend that's going to gain a lot of momentum, and suddenly you've got 10 to 15% less in global trade that's dollar-based. So it's not just going to be a slow rise. It's going to have some quantum jumps. We call them nonlinear in statistics, or discontinuous, disruptive. Okay, that's just the trade side. Nations of the world now are really angry that we've gone to QE to infinity. That's my nasty term for QE that has no limits, because we've got a phenomenon going on right now where it's $1 trillion a month in hidden QE. It's showing up as the reverse repo category on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. It is nothing but hidden, gargantuan money printing for the benefit of, I think, three different purposes. One is to cover foreign sales of treasury bonds. The Chinese sold $100 billion in August, $100 billion in July, and about $50 billion in September. That's $250 billion, $250 billion, $250 billion of Chinese-held U.S. treasuries were sold. Notice that the interest rate did not go up in the United States. So they're covering it all with new printing. And I think that there's some involvement of the Belgian central bank. There was a big bulge of $400 billion showing up there a little over a year ago. And I think that a number of different, outposts are being used to cover the hidden QE for the Federal Reserve. They're actually called the BLICS countries, B-L-I-C-S, Belgium, Luxembourg, Ireland, Cayman Islands, and Switzerland. They have equal volume to what the Fed has admitted to printing. So bang, right out of the gate, you've got double. Add in the couple trillion in the reverse repo window. You've got numerous, several trillion dollars in the last year of money printing. So nations of the world are saying, we don't want to hold treasuries anymore. If you're going to employ, deploy. If you're going to deploy a Zimbabwe-type monetary policy like Robert Mugabe did, who got decried horribly in the Western press, but now we're doing it on a global scale and we're calling it stimulus. I mean, this is like, 1984. What's the word? Not Fed speak. We call it Fed speak right now, but George Orwell had a word for it. It was something speak, like good speak, or I can't remember. It's just stupid talk. So nations of the world are concluding we need to get rid of our treasury bonds sitting in our banks before they go worthless. And they're trying to buy up a lot of gold. Now, as all these movements come in, you're getting various platforms led by the Chinese, like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which is their development bank, which means that the new development bank for the BRICS is not a development bank. The BRICS Development Bank is going to be a huge window to sell off treasury bonds, euro bonds, gilts, and Japanese yen. What do you call them? Japanese government bonds, JGBs. The new development bank for the BRICS is going to be to dump Western sovereign bonds and buy gold. So all these things are coming together, and the U.S. is going to have to come up with a currency to guarantee their own imports. And in doing so, it has to be devalued, because we've got $1 trillion deficit federally and $500 billion deficit in trade. We're going to resemble, Dennis, Venezuela. They had a 75% currency devaluation in 2013 in two steps, 35% and 40%. Bang, bang, just several months apart. Bang, bang. What's the result of a currency decline like that? It means that everything that they import just tripled in price. So what is Venezuela doing to react to this? They're selling as exports a majority of their rice, a majority of their beans, a majority of their oil, and a majority of their toilet paper.
Jim, we have a
shortage is coming to the United States.
Wow. Okay. That's exactly where I wanted to go. How are our listeners going to be affected? We're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Jim Willey. He's the editor of the Hat Trick Letter. And Everything Financial Radio will return after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. Before I get on with this segment, let me just take a moment to thank our special guest today, Mr. John Duty of GoldStockAnalyst.com, and Mr. Bob Burphy, author of the book Choice. In fact, you'll hear the second part of my interview with John Duty on next week's program. You know, there was a piece that caught my eye this past week, written by a gentleman by the name of Jim Quinn, and it has a rather provocative headline. The headline is this: the table is set for the next financial crisis. Now, I've been saying that we're seeing a lot of the same policies by the big banks that we saw prior to the financial crisis, and I happen to believe that it's very likely we see something similar to what we saw in 2008 again in the near future. And Mr. Quinn really makes a very nice argument to that effect, and I bring this up because you're not hearing this from a lot of different places. We do talk about this in our new retirement rules class, and we talk to people about strategies to potentially protect themselves moving ahead. I also talk about this in the revised version of my book, New Retirement Rules. Let me give you a bit from the piece by Mr. Quinn. He said the housing market peaked in 2005 and proceeded to crash over the next 5 years, with existing home sales falling 50%, new home sales falling 75%, and national home prices falling 30%. He then says a funny thing happened after the peak. Wall Street banks accelerated the issuance of some subprime mortgages to hyperspeed. Now, when you take a look at what happened back in prior to the financial crisis, we saw that there were no money down mortgages. You really didn't need to document income to get a mortgage. You just had to have a pay stub. A lot of the rating agencies rated a lot of these subprime mortgages as AAA, and bankers at the time made a lot of money. Now, back during that time frame, then Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan helped create this atmosphere, in my opinion. Interest rates after the dot-com tech stock bubble bust were reduced and another bubble was created. And usually, as we talk about with our economic cycles and money currency cycles that we talk about on the Everything Financial Radio program here nearly every week, easy money creates bubbles and bubbles eventually burst. Well, inevitably, when Mr. Greenspan reduced interest rates after the tech stock bubble, another bubble was created, and that was the housing bubble. Now, the housing bubble really accelerated because folks with subprime credit scores, meaning a credit score below 620, are given loans. And giving a subprime borrower a loan to buy a $250,000 home or a $30,000 automobile when they have a credit score that low, and incidentally, if you have a credit score below 620, it probably means you've missed multiple payments on credit cards, payments on loans, you have items in collection, or maybe you have a recent bankruptcy or foreclosure. And yet, banks were loaning these types of borrowers money, very little money down or even no money down to buy a home or buy an automobile. Well, if we take a look at what's happening today, the Fed has printed more than $4 trillion in new money. There have been 6 years of 0% interest rates and $8 trillion of deficit spending by the federal government. So it feels like, by some accounts, that the economy is in recovery. However, when you look at the standard of living for most Americans, it has declined and declined significantly. Real median household income is still today 6.5% below 2007 levels, 7.3% below 2000 levels, and about equal to income levels in 1989. Now, this recovery, which I believe is artificial, and many others have really pointed out as being artificial in their views, has happened by ramping up the printing presses, and we've, in my view, reignited a housing bubble, an auto bubble, and I believe we also have a student loan bubble. And Mr. Quinn provides a number of documentation points in his article to back this up. Now, the housing recovery, we actually saw a bottom, according to Mr. Quinn, in 2009 in the housing market with an annual sale rate of 4 million existing homes. In 2010, there was 3.5 million sales of existing homes after a first-time home buyer credit expired, and the current rate at 5.31 million, while higher than it was in 2010, is at 2007 crash levels and on 2001 recession levels. Mr. Quinn points out that mortgage rates are at record low levels for 5 years, and this is all we have. We've got the same level of home sales as we had in 2001. Mr. Quinn, and I'm quoting from his article now, says what really smells is the number of actual mortgage originations. If you take a look, mortgage originations are 55% below 2007 levels. If you take a look at median prices of new homes, Median price for new homes is now higher than it was in 2005, and yet originations are down. How can this happen? Well, Mr. Quinn points out that it's a result of Federal Reserve policy. When you make it easy for people to borrow money, they borrow money. He quotes John Hussman, who's a very bright guy. Mr. Hussman sums up the solution offered by the Fed this way. He said the main impact of suppressed interest rates is to encourage yield-seeking speculation to give low-quality creditors access to the capital markets, in other words, loan people with low credit scores money, to misallocate scarce saving, to subsidize leverage carry trades, this is really trades done by the big banks, and to reduce the long-term accumulation of productive capital and to foment serial bubbles and crashes. Now, if we take a look at what's going on today, we've seen a rebound in the housing market. We've seen a rebound in auto sales. However, it's starting to slump. Existing home sales dropped 4.8% during the month of August. And mortgages are now declining. Mortgage originations are declining in spite of the fact that you can get an FHA loan with a credit score as low as 500 as long as you have 10% down. And once you have a 580 credit score, you need only 3.5% down. The same thing is happening today that happened prior to the financial crisis. And a number of rating agencies are rating these loans AAA. Now, if you look at the auto market, from 2009, when there were 10.4 million annual sales, and 2015, when there were 17.5 million, the number of subprime borrowers accounts for 23.5% of the increase, and leases account for another 30% of the increase. And the vast majority of the other sales are done with 7 years, 0% financing. That is a bubble waiting to burst as well. Now, I bring all this up because, as my history professor said, those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. And we believe we are close to repeating what we saw back in 2008. If you'd like to get more information on strategies that you might implement to protect yourself, if you'd like to get into these details and this data in a lot more detail, I would encourage you to check out our new retirement rules class. We've got one more class coming up this year. It will be held on November the 14th. It will be held at the Western Michigan University campus in Grand Rapids. And you can get more information by visiting the website newretirementrules.com. The website is newretirementrules.com, and again, this will be our last class this year, held on November 14. That is a Saturday. The class will begin at 9 a.m. and conclude at 2:30 p.m. Visit the website newretirementrules.com for more information. That's our show for this week. Hope you got something you can use. I'll be back again next week, same time. Be sure to tune in. Bye.